Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Kids books. There's Pat the Bunny, I Love You Forever, Fancy Nancy, The Day the Crayons Quit, there's Big Nate, Captain Underpants, a whole list. I have a 9-year-old, so I have read many of them. But what about some stories that lull your kids to sleep talking about money? Other than, of course, the CFA handbook, which would definitely put them to sleep. Kid Smart Money's Mark Tilden will be here to tell us about the adventures of Princess Malachi and Prince Pete. And we'll talk about a new home maintenance service that promises to keep on top of everything around your house so you don't have to. It's called Setter. Then Jim Yee on common investment mistakes made by retirees. Plus, how to get rid of your debt and create a repayment plan that's right for you. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Debt is a part of life for most people. Mortgages, student loans, line of credit, and credit card debt. Getting it under control is stressful. It can be intimidating. Shannon Lee Simmons would like to do something to mitigate the stress and intimidation. She is a certified financial planner, the founder of the New School of Finance, and the author of Living Debt Free. She joins us now to talk about her latest book and how you can come up with a debt repayment plan that works for you. Hello there.
Hi.
You wrote a second book. What were you thinking?
I wasn't, Bruce.
You were not thinking.
I know. And like quickly, too. So I need a bit of a timeout for a minute. But I love this book so much. So when the opportunity came up, I was like, I've always wanted to write a loving book about debt. So I got an opportunity and I had to do it.
You have some experience in this world, $13,000 in credit card debt. So I read about the circumstances that led you to that point, but what was the turning point that in hindsight that you look back to when you developed a plan to eliminate that debt?
Yeah, I think it was when I felt like out of options, right? So when it was in the beginning and it started to climb, I kept thinking, oh, it's manageable. I'll deal with that like next week or next month or whatever, like that's okay. And then as it started getting bigger and bigger, I started ignoring it more and more because I was like, oh my God, I can't do anything about this. And then finally, the stress and anxiety of having that debt looming over me and the stark realization that there's nowhere else to go. I had maxed out my credit card. I was like,
Oh, there's that.
Yeah, I have to do something. So the reality stick, kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, oh my gosh, this is completely out of hand. And what am I doing? And this is crazy. So, I'm still embarrassed talking. I mean, I was like so young at the time, but I'm still embarrassed talking about it because it was just so unlike me. And I think that's why it's important to share those stories, because I was a certified financial planner at the time. I had all the information I needed. I knew every time I swiped the card I shouldn't. And yet I still found myself in a spiral because of certain circumstances in my life. And I think that is such a relatable thing. And I think it's made me a better financial planner.
Yeah. So maybe it was a good thing that you were in that much debt. It's so helpful. It's so helpful to you. If you had a do-over, you'd go into even more debt. It would be even more helpful.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
So tell me about this concept called the debt loop. What is that?
Yeah, that was kind of how I explained my own experience. And then now what I see with clients on a daily basis when those people who come in are battling debt. So essentially, the threshold to go from somebody who doesn't have debt to a person that does is a big one. It's emotionally, noticeable. So if you're a person that never carries a balance on a credit card and then all of a sudden you buy something and you can't pay it off and you have $400 on your credit card, that it triggers a guilt, an anxiety, a fear, like, oh my God, I overspent this month. And so that threshold is a big one. What happens in a debt loop, though, is that most people don't go into debt for the first time because they're going to Mexico or something like that. Most of the time it was circumstantial, unless it was like they got asked to be a bridesmaid in their friend's wedding and they're going. That maybe, yes, they might have gone to Mexico. But most of the time it's like their cat got sick, maybe they had a job loss, maybe somebody in their family was sick, they needed to retrain for a program or something. So to go from that person who doesn't have debt to having debt is usually significant and not frivolous spending. But now you have less money every month to survive your normal life. And normal life costs money. But now a portion of your income is going towards interest and paying back that debt. And so then life inevitably throws you another curveball. You have less money to work with. The debt starts
and
piling
so on and so on.
Right.
And so on.
Once you're in the loop, the problem is, you know, if you've got $4,000 on a credit card, what's another $400 at that point?
Right.
And that's where the frivolous spending that everyone likes to point their finger at and say, they're just bad with money. That's when that kind of mentality takes over. But that's not usually in the beginning. It's usually after you've been spiraling for quite some time.
You talk about two types of financial tripwires. What are those two types?
Yeah, so emotional and routine are the typical ones that get us into some trouble. And so the routine ones are the ones that maybe people would be more familiar with. So often this can show up like, every time I go into Costco, I try to spend $80 but end up spending $200. Or every time I go into the repair store or like Home Depot or something, I want to go in to buy a wrench and I end up spending $150. Like there's certain places or stores or sales that can be one of those like routine triggers for you. Or like, and the example I use in the book, my one client, she was bored on her lunch break. So she was always kind of mindlessly overspending on her lunch break because she didn't want to go outside. It was cold. And she was like wandering the mall out of boredom. So she would like go buy $10 here and $15 here just for something to do, but she didn't even realize it. So it's like that mindless spending that you're doing because you're kind of in a bad habit of doing it. And then the other kind that I see is more an emotional trigger. So these are like positive or negative feelings that make you want to overspend to either keep the high going or avoid the negative feeling. So if you're feeling inadequate, like one of my clients just the other day, she's like just feeling down about herself. She's been on a bunch of bad dates. And she's like, I just like totally blew through my budget on some new clothes because I just want to feel good for like 2 seconds, right? So that inadequacy is driving that. That's a trigger. And then there's also people who, on a positive note, like let's say you're on vacation, you're like, screw it, I'm on vacation. Like,
you only live once.
Swiping. Exactly. Or you're celebrating or you're hosting or whatever. So hosting is a place where a lot of people kind of do that emotional overspending because they want to like make a lovely place for their friends and family. And then they end up buying too much cheese.
Yeah, I love it. This emotional thing, it's analogous to how I ate almost an entire box of Girl Guide cookies after a bad day last week. It wasn't spending,
absolutely,
but it was eating. Now, one of the things that as people think about their repayment plan, they know how much is outstanding. You advocate for figuring out your magic amount when it comes to debt repayment. Is this because you want to make sure you increase the probability of them being successful?
Absolutely.
So they're not deluded in their optimism.
No, I hate those overly aggressive financial plans that are like, pay out $60,000 in 3 months. I think that it sets people up for failure, first of all. Then they feel like garbage because they've just failed their debt repayment plan. There's nothing. It's like kicking you while you're down.
Yeah.
And then and then you lose motivation. You're like, well, what's the point? I'm not good with money. And it kind of reaffirms that self-talk that you're bad with money. So I think if we can make like a more reasonable approach to it.
How do you figure out what that number is? How do you come up with that number?
So for me, the best thing to do is most times I advocate for what do you make every month? What are your bills? What do you want to save? And then kind of what's left over is where we draw a line in the sand between the money we can and can't spend. And that's now you're spending money. So basically the goal drives how much spending money you have left over. With debt, there's obviously a cash flow issue. It's not the same mentality as when you're building a savings plan, when you're building a debt repayment plan, because if you have debt, there's not enough cash flow happening every month. Like that's the problem. So what I'll turn my own advice on its head and go about it the other way. So, okay, what are our bills? And then I'll look at what is your average spending over the last, over 3 months. It's pretty typical spending, like obviously not the holidays and obviously not you on your best behavior, but like really just you on average. Let's look at 3 months of spending. What is that number? So if it's $1,000 a month on average over 3 months, then I need to make sure that you have around $1,000 a month for spending money, or else I'm going to set you up for failure. So then what I would do is, this is what you have coming in. This is what you have going out for bills. Let's put aside $1,000 to make sure you have an average typical month worth of spending money. And then what's left over is our magic amount. So I work it backwards with debt repayment plans because the cash flow is the core problem.
Right.
The worst thing I can do is tell someone like, okay, well, now you have $600 a month. Okay, bye.
Bye.
And they're spending $1,000. They're just going to keep going into debt.
debt so slammers. I want to move on to debt slammers quickly. Lowering the rate, lump sums. Talk about some of these things that can be a really high impact.
Yeah, those are just basically things that are going to kick your plan into overdrive. So first things first, consolidate. Everyone knows that tip, but people rarely actually take the plunge into it. So if you've got a line of credit, pay off your credit cards with it, lower the interest rate. You can have such a better impact that the small amounts that you are putting towards debt actually have a chance at hitting principal. And then the lump sums is really important because, again, it feels really nice to see savings in our bank account. Not necessarily, like, it feels better to see $1,000 in a savings account than it does to see a line of credit go from 18 grand to 17 grand. But the net worth went up by $1,000 no matter what. So I always have to remind people that paying down debt above the principal is also a form of savings. And so if you've got savings sitting on the side, not in an RRSP, take it and throw it at your debt because it's going to kickstart your whole plan. And often over the long run, you'll actually end up with more money in your pocket because you won't be wasting so much time and energy going towards interest. So it's, you're playing the long game a little bit, and it's a scary thing to do. But often when you see what happens over 3 or 4 years, you're like, well, there's no other option except to empty out this account.
We've only got 30 seconds left. And in that time, I would like your number one tip to reduce the risk of recurrence. Because what we see sometimes is people get themselves out, they haul themselves out, and then life continues to happen, marriage, divorce, kids, What is your number one thing that you would have people focus on so that the pattern doesn't continue?
Slowly build emergency savings at the same time as repaying debt so that when life throws you a lemon, you can handle it without throwing your debt repayment plan off the rails.
Right. Oh, that important thing. Shannon, thank you very much. And congratulations on releasing book number 2.
Thank you.
Shannon Lee Simmons is a certified financial planner. She is the founder of the New School of Finance. And her latest book is called Living Debt Free.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We had owned our house for 3 years. When I had someone come over to look at the furnace, he asked when the last time was that I had changed the air filter, and he may as well as asked me about what they serve at a wedding in Ulan Bator, Mongolia, because of course I didn't know the answer. I never even considered the question. Maintenance is what you do when something is broken and you have no heat. That's when you pay attention. It's something when the impact of the broken thing becomes untenable. There is now this company called Setter, and they promise to oversee home maintenance. They set you up with all sorts of people. There's an app. The benefits of this is clear, especially to someone like me, but is it worth the cost? Andrew Black joins us now from Setter. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
So this was a response to a need that one of your founders, David Steckel, saw after he built some custom homes. And he said clients, they wouldn't leave him alone. They kept calling him and saying, help me. Tell us about this phenomenon of the homeowner. I think I'm like that typical person.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're in the same boat as most people in the city. But that was the impetus of it all, is we were both home builders, Dave and I, and as soon as we had finished building a home, they would continue to come back to us for just general maintenance questions and simple questions that we actually had laid out for them. But since we were such an easy point of contact, they decided just give Dave or Andrew a call. They'll come and take care of it for us. They'll know. They'll know what to do. So, hey, why don't we capitalize on this? And hence, we came up with this idea, Setter.
Setter, we're a North American show, but I should acknowledge that this is a Bay Area and a Toronto service currently.
Currently, yes.
So if you're living in Kelowna, you can't get this here yet. Give us the basics on how Setter works.
Okay, so it's a subscription based app. You simply download the app, you subscribe. It's as simple as just typing in what you need done, and our home service manager will address it for you. We can take it one step further and have them actually get to know your home. So we are in a better position to service the home when there is an issue. So by personalizing this, we can more effectively service your home.
And how much does it cost? How does it work?
Okay, so there's no fee. It's free to sign up. Anyone can download the app and start using the app immediately. Obviously, when we service the home, then there's a charge.
And how much is the charge?
So you're paying industry rates. So we're utilizing our resources and our buying power by using these trades all the time. So we're getting a discounted rate, and we mark that rate up.
By
so
how
you're
much?
Still paying retail.
Oh, you still pay retail. I see.
So you're still going to pay retail. If you're going to if you're going directly to a plumber or an appliance service guy, you're going to pay the same as if you were to go to us as well. Just if you were to go to us, you're paying the same as you pay them direct, except you have someone taking ownership of that service.
Right.
And someone that's accountable for
it. In a city like Toronto, it can be very difficult to find trades, and in other major cities, not just Toronto. How do you find the tradespeople that will then deliver the service?
Well, once we build these relationships with the trades, it's a lot more easy to communicate with them. But from a homeowner's perspective, if you were to go direct to a trade that doesn't know you, you're at the bottom of the priority list. So this way, we keep you at the top of their priority list, and we have our home managers be the one that are accountable for that service.
How do you get ahead of things? Because I think that's the biggest issue that I have. I walk into my home and I do not see anything that would need my attention unless it's broken. I just have a blind spot around that. So how do you distinguish between what is a response to a problem? And then I would text my setter home manager and say, my furnace doesn't work.
Right.
And getting ahead of that and saying, Bruce, you actually need someone to come and change the filter or at least look at the eaves troughs or those kinds of things that I literally will never think of.
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea behind it is being preventative instead of reactive. Most people just wait, just like you do. You wait until the furnace filter's clogged and your furnace stops working, and then you would call a service appliance or mechanic to come fix it, right? So by doing preventative service, we come and we do a home diagnostic. So we'll come and do an initial diagnostic and see the home and make all these points and notes and items that you need to address now and in the future. And then we set up an email will be sent out to you for a list of all the items that we've diagnosed that need attention and will need attention. And you can check off the ones that you want to address now. And as we send our quarterly email, you're going to get that follow-up email with the items that you didn't do that time. And again, ask, would you like to do this now? It is recommended to do this, this, and this. And it simplifies homeownership, so you don't have to think about it.
Does it bill through the platform?
It's all billed to the platform.
It's all billed for the platform, so I don't have to worry about writing
credit
checks
card
to 12 people.
Uploaded to this, yeah.
How has technology made Setter possible in a way that it wouldn't have been or wouldn't have been as easy a business to run before Uber, Airbnb, all those other things that really provide a seamless connection between consumers and people who can deliver service?
I mean, the technology provides the consumer a way much more simplified approach to managing their home and the maintenance of their home. But from on the back end, it's enabled us to be able to coordinate all the people that are managing all the partners involved with managing and taking care of a home. So our trades are on the app. We're on the app. The invoicing and the billing and everything is all consolidated into one nice little format. Otherwise, tracking all these moving parts is near impossible, especially when you're scaling a business like this.
What would you say is your target market in terms of how expensive the house would need to be in order for this to make sense? Or an income? Like, what's the – you're not going to do it for, a house in which people are handy or they don't have a lot of disposable income. Like, this seems to be focused towards a particular income bracket.
Yeah, I think the urban centers are definitely our targets. People are busier. They have active families. They have dual incomes. It's not on top of mind to want to repair something on their own. It's more of a convenience factor. If someone has the time living in the city to be a DIY guy, they're not going to want to use service because they actually enjoy doing it.
Right.
But 90% of the Toronto population, they don't have time. We're busy. Everyone's busy with their families, and being able to have the time spent on your family instead of maintaining your home is invaluable for sure.
I put a new burner in my barbecue last summer. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty proud about that. But that's about it. And there was a lot of YouTube videos involved in doing that. What tasks don't you cover? Like, because when it comes to home maintenance, there's house cleaning, there's snow removal, there's house sitting, there's like tons of other stuff. Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, so we will do seasonal maintenance, absolutely. I know where we draw the line is when it becomes a project-based project. So if someone wants to do a whole bathroom and we have to coordinate 5-10 different trades, then you're into either a handyman or a construction company. So it's the one-off tickets. So a window cleaning, a trough cleaning, a new roof, carpet cleaning, furniture, steam cleaning, lawn care, power washing, that kind of thing.
How do you handle access to the properties?
So that's okay. So that's where Setter is has a main differentiator from a lot of the competitors out there. So since we have a dedicated home manager, they know your home. So you will build a relationship with these people, and when you feel comfortable, we'll actually be granted access to the home. So another level of convenience, if you're at work and you find out something's going wrong with your alarms going off or your sump pump stopped working, you can simply text into the app and we would have access to your home. You don't have to wait at your
through
home.
Through a key or a lockbox?
Yeah, so we would actually have, right, so we have a keypad that we would put on probably a back door or a side door. So we would have access through that keypad.
Interesting. Always keypad, not lockbox?
In some cases, yes. So it's owner preference.
What has been the hardest part to scale of this business? Because this is high touch. This is not an easy. It is not an easy business.
Yes. So yes, we do have the formula, but the challenging part behind it is managing trades, because we're still managing people. So the stuff that you don't see on the back line is when a trade fails to come and or a trade fails to do the work, and we're the accountable one, so we have to pick up the slack and make sure it gets done properly. So that's the hard part to scale, because it's hard to absolutely understand how effective all of our trades are going to be on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Interesting. Andrew Black is with Setter. Setter is a relatively new company available with service in the Bay Area and Toronto. Home maintenance simplified, I guess is what you'd say. Andrew, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, consumer financing company, Finance It. CEO Michael Garrity will be our guest. And later, the most common investment mistakes made by retirees. This is a radio show, of course, but I also do a lot of TV, in particular for a nationally syndicated television program called Cityline. All of that material is on the Cityline site, cityline.tv. Take a look through some of the awesome stuff, not just stuff I do, but chefs and decor and fashion. So many different things out there. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The stifling humidity of an extra sticky summer's day has descended upon you and your entire family. Yesterday, you had a working air conditioner to save you from losing your ever-loving mind. But today, you don't, because it's broken. You need a new air conditioner now, like right now. But you can't afford one unless you can get financing. Michael Garrity is the president and CEO of Finance It, and his fintech is out to make consumer financing easy and accessible. That sounds like a marketing selling line. Michael, hello. You can picture what it's like on a hot summer day. That should be the pitch.
I like it. Now, it could also be the middle of winter. February in Edmonton would be equally compelling as
right.
a picture.
Hopefully it's a heater we're talking about there. Consumer financing has been around since the General Store on Little House on the Prairie. If you remember that show, you're old enough to know that show. Yeah. What is different with Finance It than the ways that people could borrow money to buy big stuff?
Sure. I think what we're trying to do is to make the entire process a lot easier. So it's really a merchant who's out talking to you about your broken air conditioner unit or your faulty heater in the middle of winter. It's something they care a lot about. It's their home. So you're going to call somebody out. You're going to get an estimate and you're going to get a big price tag. And it's a likely purchase that you weren't thinking about 15 minutes before the thing broke. And now you're going to have to figure out what your budget is. And really what we do is we make virtual budgets available that can be delivered through a mobile app in your home by that guy that's giving you the estimate.
What did the merchant do before you? Did they say, sorry, go to your bank and get a home equity line of credit? Or did they have another consumer financing offer? It was just cumbersome.
I think either one of those two. Generally, what would have happened with that purchase is that they would have told you how much it was, and then you might negotiate a little bit on what the price is ultimately going to be, and then you're going to have to come up with the cash. And whether that merchant accepts a credit card, which then it's going to be
pay
good
off
for them.
24% interest.
Right. Then you're going to have a 24% interest loan. Essentially, that you're going to have to figure out how to then get the cash to pay off, or you're going to tap into your savings, or if you're lucky enough to have a HELOC or home equity line of credit that has space on it, you're going to go and use that and draw it out of your bank account and essentially make a payment. Any one of those options are definitely not very convenient for you in that moment, other than, let's say, the use of the credit card, but then it's not convenient for you when the money's due.
Yeah.
Because you sold your soul.
Exactly. Yeah.
What interest rate does the consumer end up paying? And I know I'm, well, I shouldn't say I know. I would bet it's connected to a bunch of different variables.
Yeah. It's, you know, size of the loan is one of the variables. Your credit history is another one of the variables. But we try to aim for, you know, call it 7 to 8% the majority of the time. So the idea
so
here
well
is.
So well below a credit card, but well above a fully secured line of credit.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's a great way to position us. Installment loans across the board are generally fall in that category.
And an installment loan means that a part of the agreement is that it's the same amount per month for a fixed period. It's not.
And a fixed rate, right? Right. So people seem to forget in this really low rate environment that we're currently in, that we're all expected to get out of relatively soon, if you're on a variable rate and all home equity lines of credit are variable rates. So you're going to borrow a whole bunch of money today and the interest rate's going to seem a little low. And over the next 5 years or 10 years, which is how long our loans are willing to go for, we give you a fixed rate and a fixed term. So you have certainty of payment. A home equity line of credit could literally go up by 5% over the next 5 years, and there's nothing you can do about
it. Right. How does the approval process differ than another option like a bank, like getting an installment loan at a bank?
Yeah. So getting an installment loan at the bank normally involves—
You have to go there.
Yeah. You have the physicality of it. You have to make an appointment at some bank. And less people these days actually have a connection to their bank, right? Millennials don't even think about branches anymore. That's not how they think about banking. So you have to go to a bank. You have to make an appointment to go see somebody. You usually have to go in and tell your story or show some things associated with your financial life. And the entire thing doesn't feel very convenient, even if you do get a great rate as a result.
So the consumer gets the air conditioner, hooray for them. Yep. But there are a lot of discretionary purchases that might get funding too. Does that worry you? Does making lending more broadly available worry you?
Yeah, our focus—
Not as a business leader, because of course you want people to borrow and buy stuff, because that's how you make money, but as a human being on this planet.
Well, no, for sure. We specifically emphasize responsible lending. And responsible lending means we won't lend to you if this loan doesn't fit within an affordability criteria for you, or if your credit is so weak that you really shouldn't be borrowing money more money.
What credit score would punt someone out of the line?
Yeah, most people— I'm going to say a number, but most people have no idea when I say this number, what it actually means.
Yep.
Canadians are remarkably oblivious to their credit score. And
right.
I think
they
that's
think credit score is a channel that offers sports on television.
That's right.
Or something like that.
Oh, the credit score. Yeah, join us today.
Today on the credit score.
So 640 is our beginning point and higher, which is typically considered prime.
Right. So if you've had a history of not paying off your credit card, you missed it a couple times, and your score is below that level, you're just not going to be a customer for you.
Yeah. We're going to say we're really sorry that we can't lend to you today. Here are some great ways that you can improve your credit score, which will help you across your life.
Next time. Not this time.
Or find somebody else in your life who can be a co-borrower on this particular loan so that we can still get you this thing and help you to budget for it, which is our value proposition. We just need you to bring somebody else, you know, a significant other, a parent, into the mix who's got better
credit.
Your
dealer, your mafia connections.
I'm not saying anything right
now. No, you are not. Very well done. What happens if a customer doesn't pay?
All the same things that would happen with a bank if you don't pay.
You go
or
out
a credit card
thumbs.
Company. No breaking of thumbs. That's illegal. So we will we'll certainly let you know that you're missing payments or that you've NSF'd the payments that we are meant to take. We want to work with you and find a way for you to get back to making these payments. It's really important for people to understand that when they miss payments, it hurts their credit file. It hurts the way that other people look at them as a financially responsible person. It increases the rates by which they can borrow or makes it impossible to borrow in the future. And that's really the key of the conversation for us, is to make sure people understand that and help them to find a way to get back to making these payments.
Where does your capital come from?
So we have a set of financial institutions, whether they're banks or life cos that we work with. All of them are interested in lending money to good quality borrowers who pay back. And they know how hard it is to reach this part of the market, what's called point of sale lending. So they work with us in partnership. We do all the heavy lifting, all the hard work at the front.
It's an iPad. It's not that heavy.
Oh, it's
really
it's so much thinking went into the iPad,
I'm
though.
Sure.
So all that part. part, technology, service, that stuff is hard for a lot of big institutions. So they bring the balance sheet. We bring the operational wherewithal. It's a great partnership.
What are the barriers to entry for the big banks from getting in there? I mean, I'm not saying it's simple to develop an app, a mobile app, but lots of them do. Why don't they just do it themselves?
Well, it's a great question, and it kind of relates to an announcement that we made about 6 months ago where we announced that we actually purchased the division of the second largest bank in Canada, TD. So they had a similar service, home improvement lending. They've been operating it within the bank for the last 10-plus years. They were really struggling to have it grow, to stay up with technology, to give it the focus that it needed within a big bank where they have a lot of big product areas. And this one seemed relatively small and hard work. So we approached them, talked to them about how we could take the business over and add it into our business. We agreed. We announced the financial terms about 6 months ago.
What does the consumer see? Are they, is the air conditioning salesperson saying, hey, I've got financing from Finance It? Or is it
exactly what they say?
They are. That's what they say. In that cheesy voice. Hey.
They don't like that. Have to use that cheesy
but they
voice.
Could. They could. I could
they
teach them
welcome.
How to. Hey.
Yeah.
And is it entirely in-app or is there paper?
We can default to paper. A lot of the contractors that we work with, a little older school,
want paper,
right? And they feel more comfortable with a paper
but
app.
But can it be entirely an app?
Of course.
Can someone sign with their finger?
Sign with their finger on their iPad or in their mobile device without having to download our app at all.
Interesting. Michael, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Michael Garrity is the president and CEO of Finance It, consumer lending on an app. Wow. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala How I Do It segment with Shannon Lee Simmons. She's the author of Living Debt Free. But next, we're going to talk to KidSmart Money's Mark Tilden about his children's bedtime story that teaches kids about money. Now, if you've got questions about money, I've done a whole bunch of columns over the last decade or so for MoneySense. You can go to moneysense.ca and search some of the awesome stuff on there written by all sorts of great people. Dave Ashton, Jason Heath, Dan Bortolotti. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
So you want to teach your kids or your grandkids or your nieces and nephews about money, but don't really know where to start. How about a bedtime story? Mark Tilden is the Chief Advocate General at KidSmart Money, the author of The Adventures of Princess Michaela and Prince Pete. He joins us now to tell us about his fictional children's book. Well, the book's real. It's a fictional world, I guess, that aims to teach kids real life lessons about money. Hello there.
Hi.
You have a 9-year-old.
I do.
She's the Michaela in the title.
She is.
Why did you decide to write a kid's book?
Well, it mattered to me. I'm an investment advisor. I have been for 18 years.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to teach my kid to have some financial basics that my parents didn't think about teaching me.
Right.
So when she was 4 years old, I looked around on the internet to try and find books for her. Couldn't find a thing.
Yeah.
So I decided to adapt some of the bedtime stories that I made up for her and incorporate age-appropriate financial concepts that she could learn into fun stories.
From one in your book called Witchy Poos, there's this scene at a market, and it says, Queen Mummy turned to her children and asked, which has more value, the strawberries or the blueberries? The blueberries, shouted Princess Michaela before continuing, because we get the same amount of berries for less money. Correct, answered the queen proudly. Did your daughter beam when she got to hold the book in her hands for the very first time? Was she excited?
You have no idea. My daughter is a natural theatrical little girl, and the thought of her being the star of a book just
nothing
sent her
better.
To the moon.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of the lessons that you were endeavoring to weave into the narrative in a sometimes overt and sometimes covert way.
Okay, this book is destined for what I consider to be the youngest age group,
okay,
which is about 4 to 8 years old. And I started with them partly because I started doing it for my daughter, but because I think it's the most important age group, because child psychologists have told us that through studies and studies and studies, that our habits are formed by the age of 8 years old. And yet, there is nothing out there to teach our kids good financial habits. So things such as the difference between needs and wants, these are things though kids that age can learn, but we don't think about teaching them. Other things such as delayed satisfaction. But I would say by far the most important lesson to teach kids is something that as an advisor we teach adults is called pay yourself first. Mm. For children, that can be easily transmitted by not just giving them an allowance, but making sure that they have three piggy banks to put that allowance in, not one. One for long-term saving, one for spending, and one for charity. By doing this, you reinforce their learning of what long-term savings is. Now, you may have to explain what that is to them the very first time, but once they get it, then every single week by giving them an allowance and making them split that allowance up, they are thinking about how much money to put into each one and why. Mm-hmm. And that will reinforce the habit of every time I get income, I'm going to put a certain portion of it aside for long-term savings that's going to build up.
You talk about allowances being almost a complement to the books that you have written. What are the other things that need to surround the reading of the book at nighttime that's super important for parents to take on? If it were as simple as just reading them your book every single night from age 4 to age 8, I think a lot of people say, parents say, oh, phew, that's it. Okay, good. But it isn't
that
simple.
Yeah, so let's get them doing that.
A great start. What else do they need to do in order to model that behavior in the home?
Absolutely. One of the most important things is to be interactive. Get the kids to do stuff with you. Take them shopping with you. When you take them shopping with you, young kids can understand the difference between when something's a deal and when it's not. Show them the price tickets on items that you're going to be buying. When something is on special, especially if it's staples, things that you're going to buy regularly all the time, say toilet paper or tissue paper or fruit and vegetables, and something is half price, well, you get twice as much of it. That stretches your dollar, makes it go farther. Teach kids when they're young to do this, and it will be second nature to them as they grow up.
We found Honey Bunches of Oats on sale for $2.99 a box on Sunday. It's regularly $6.49, which means I never buy it.
Right.
But it was on sale. Abby was so excited. She was the one that discovered it. She was like, this is the best. We got three boxes, of course. Now, there are many parents out there, even those who listen to a show like mine, who don't feel comfortable. They are not necessarily effective in their own life managing right. their money, or it's a real blind spot for them. What would you say to people for whom this is, they're not an investment advisor in their real life, and this is not something that they would say is a strength?
I would say I completely understand. I mean, this is probably the major stumbling block that we have to teaching our kids financial literacy is that as a rule in our society, parents haven't taught it to their kids. So as parents, we weren't taught. So we don't know how to go about it. And quite often, we will feel inadequate in being able to pass that on. So the best you can do is the best you can do. And if that means finding books like mine or finding games online to be able to teach your kids, then do that. One of the things that I'm trying very hard to do right now is to lobby with an organization, a nonprofit organization called LEARN, which is a acronym for Leading Education and Resource Networking. And their whole goal in life is to be able to provide content for primary and secondary schools.
Right.
And I'm lobbying them to be able to create a position where I can help create a curriculum both for children to be included in schools from kindergarten all the way through mm-hmm. the end of the high school, because mm-hmm. that's fundamental, and also to be able to create some kind of a program to be able to teach the teachers, because they're yeah. facing exactly the same problem yeah. that you're describing for parents.
What's your next fiction project? Is it for teens? Is it based on the Twilight series? Is it fan fiction? Is it sci-fi? What are you doing for the 14-year-olds?
Well, the next group that I would like to touch would be the next one going up, 8 to 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to write a third book for kids from 13 to 17. And the next one that I'm working on will involve some kind of a superhero, probably with a sidekick that's maybe a little bumbling, but somebody who can learn from their mistakes the next level, the next age-appropriate concepts that need to be learned.
And their superpower could be making debt disappear. You can use that, Mark. You can use that.
Gee, thanks. I don't have to give you royalties.
You do not. Mark Tilden is the author of The Adventures of Princess Michaela and Prince Pete. You can Google that and find a link to how you can get it yourself. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Can I throw in one last thing?
You can.
They are available currently as print on demand from all your major retailers, including Amazon.com.ca, Chapters Indigo, and Barnes & Noble.
Super simple. Arrive in your mailbox. Easy breezy. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up next, the most common investment mistakes made by retirees. So they are well outside of the target audience for this book. Maybe they should pick it up and get to it now. Jim Yee will be our guest. He's with Retire Happy. And we're going to talk to Shannon Lee Simmons again with our How I Do It segment, getting into the nitty-gritty of how she manages her own money. If you want to join in the conversation, you can shoot us a message to ask@moolala.ca, M-O-O-L-A-L-A.ca. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
More and more Canadians will retire with multiple retirement income sources. Paltry though they may be, they'll be from a number of different sources. They may have a government pension, maybe they've got a company pension of some sort, maybe they've got an RRSP, some non-registered investments, maybe some cash in a TFSA or something. Jim Yee is a retirement expert, the founder of Retire Happy. He joins us today to talk about some of the common investment mistakes made by retirees when managing these different assets and how to avoid those mistakes. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
So much fodder here. Mistake number one that you talk about is planning to live off dividends. Now, as an idea, that's not a bad idea. What is the mistake in your view?
Well, I think the mistake is, it's maybe not a mistake, but a challenge. The challenge that we see is everyone that retires, it's so much easier to live off a paycheck than it is to live off an asset. And that's because it's easy to spend a paycheck because you know the next one's always coming.
Right.
And that's not always easy to replicate in retirement. So when you save a bunch of RSPs and you have an asset, everyone seems to want to preserve the capital and just spend the interest or the dividends or the growth. They want to preserve that capital. And so dividend investing is very popular today. I'm a big fan of it, actually, but data shows that dividend rates are coming down a little bit and that, you know, the thing people need to be aware of is, why do you just want to live off the dividends? What are you preserving the capital for? Is it really to give your kids more money or your leave a bigger estate? Or is it really because it's a psychological problem? It's hard to see your capital deplete down, which is understandable. But, you know, it's the purpose of saving the money was to spend it. So it's a bit of a psychological mistake as opposed to a mathematical mistake.
Right, right. Investing for income is another one on your list. How come?
Well, the idea of investing for income is obviously what you want to do, but the problem with the dividend structure today is in Canada we're highly concentrated. All of the dividend stocks are concentrated into a couple of sectors, the energy sector, the financial sector, and so if you just focus on your dividends and that's your whole portfolio, you're going to be highly concentrated, and you know we've all heard the story of you should diversify a little bit. There would be very little diversification strategy with just the dividend,
right?
Just investing for dividend income.
People make mistakes on asset allocation. This can be really relevant for retirees, given that their income is largely fixed or to some extent fixed. How would you characterize this particular mistake?
Okay, so let's say somebody has an RSP, a TFSA, and a non-registered account. Quite often what we see is people run their asset allocation models consistently through the different accounts. So, for example, they might have one-third stocks, one-third bonds, one-third cash in the RSP, the same in the TFSA, and then the same in the non-registered. And we feel it's important not to treat your accounts as sort of homogeneous accounts. It may be better off to hold some of your safer, more secure investments inside the RSP for tax purposes, but also because you don't want your RSPs to grow really big. If you think about where would you prefer to have your growth, you'd probably prefer to have it in a TFSA because all of that growth is tax-free.
Right.
So then your TFSA should probably be allocated with more of a growth slant. And then maybe the non-registered account, that's where some of the dividends, because dividend income is tax-preferred. So be careful not to just treat all accounts the same.
Right. You need an asset allocation strategy, and then where those assets are housed is quite relevant.
Absolutely. And then we also see people who have an RSP with one financial advisor, the TFSA they're doing on their own, and then the non-registered is with
their Uncle Vinny.
Yeah, there you go. And so then there's no coordination of asset allocation. We see that happen quite often.
Not deferring pensions is on your list. This is a contentious one. I had Fred Vitesse on talking about delaying CPP, and while the math makes sense, it's a hard call for people to hold off until 70.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've spent a lot of time. Probably the number one debate for us, you know, on Retire Happy, the biggest traffic we get is this issue of when to start taking a pension, whether it's CPP or whether it's a defined benefit pension plan. And you're absolutely right. With every decision, there's a logical mathematical component, and then there's a psychological emotional component. And the math is debatable. A lot of people have accused me of being pro take CPP early, which I'm not. The math simply is the math. And many people do choose to take it early, but quite frankly, I could care less when you choose to take a CPP because it's your money, not
right.
But most people, you know, there's a mathematical break-even point. There's a calculation you can do. And most people just choose to want it early. That's not to say that that's right or wrong. It's just everyone should make that decision on their own. So we do see a bias out there. Most people want to take it early. And all we're saying here is be careful, because that's not just because my brother did it and my coworkers did it and everyone else I know took it early does not mean that you should too.
Right.
So that's all we're sort of saying is do some math, yes, but just do what's right for your situation. You know, retirement planning is not a cookie-cutter approach.
You also have one here around deferring tax. Is this the idea that sometimes people who have accumulated a lifetime of savings in an RSP are reticent to spend it down at all because they know they're going to trigger tax?
Yeah. I call it grumpy retiree syndrome. There's a lot of retirees that are grumpy about
their money. I don't know why I saved in my RSP. Now I'm paying tax. Well, yeah, it's kind of designed that way. It's tax deferral.
That's right. So we advise that as you get closer and closer to retirement, as soon as you retire, you should develop an RRSP withdrawal strategy. And that withdrawal strategy may be, in fact, to defer it. But it also may be, in fact, to start withdrawing it earlier, even if you don't need the income. It might be wise from purely a tax strategy.
What are the ways in which someone can reduce the touch on the decumulation phase? There's been so much work on, you know, the robos, making savings easy, automate, 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 hooray for everything. Is there a similar approach on the decumulation phase to make that easy?
No. And I think that's the challenge is that we have an industry that really, really understands accumulation, growth strategies, dollar cost averaging. But I think our industry is not always the best at understanding that there's a huge difference between decumulation strategies and accumulation strategies. I think it's getting better, Bruce, but I think it's because the boomers are driving this need. And I think that would be a mistake for people to try and take a cookie cutter approach.
Yeah.
So much of my time today is spent sitting down with people on that decumulation stage, and what we find is that it is not a cookie cutter approach.
You know, it's interesting as we talk, it becomes clear that we really need to tilt towards that phase of life, not just because there are more and more retirees than ever before, but because the stakes are really high. The stakes are pretty low. If you've got 20 grand and you're at a, you know, a branch of a bank and you're invested in a mutual fund, just keep doing that for a while until you've got enough and can lower your cost base. But if you're in retirement, you could have 500 grand, you could have $1 million in assets, and some serious tax implications if you don't optimize that withdrawal.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the thing, Bruce, that I've learned over the years is, you know, I'm a math guy, I'm a number cruncher, I enjoy numbers. But I got to tell you, the biggest thing that I've learned over the years is that when it comes to retirement, money, investing, psychology is way more powerful than logic. And so we try and explain models away with math and spreadsheets and things like that. But at the end of the day, I think there is a huge component. You know, there's some gut, there's emotion, and you got to respect that. You got to sometimes forget the math and just do what you think and feel is right for your life, right for, you know, the goal is to make retirement the best years of your life. That should always be the goal.
Yeah.
And sometimes we, math can't explain that. And so, important.
God, that was so touchy-feely of you, Jim. For a math guy, I feel good. I feel grateful. I feel inspired. I'm like tapping my heart in acknowledgement of your amazingness. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Bruce. Always so much fun to talk to you.
Jim Yee, retirement expert, founder of Retire Happy. We were talking about some of the most common mistakes made by retirees. And unfortunately, the list is pretty long. I'm always curious as to how real people actually manage their money, not what they should do, but what they actually do. So this is what we're getting at with our column called How I Do It. It's a series of basic questions, and we ask our guests how they manage their personal finances. Now, I always do this reminder. I would not ask any question of a guest that I would not answer myself. Our guest, Shannon Lee Simmons, author of Living Debt-Free, also a certified financial planner. Shannon, first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
Okay.
You go buy coffee at a coffee shop, assuming you drink coffee. Maybe it's tea. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit, and why?
I pay with debit because I have a checking account where all of my spending money is in it, and I never have to worry about a bill I can't pay off.
Does your debit card ever say, insufficient funds?
It could, except I watch it pretty close, and so I'll move money into it if that's the case.
Right. You're ahead of it. Do you use any financial apps? I mean, there are 12,000 of them out there. I get pitched them all the time. I think I have one that I use. I've covered all 12,000, but I only use one. Do you have any apps that you use?
No. Although I use my online banking app like every day. So if you consider that an app, then yes, my online banking, I'm glued to it and I'm in there a lot. But otherwise, I don't have any budgeting apps or anything like that.
And what do you use it for, your banking app?
So to move money around, to make sure, because I put my spending money between me and my husband in a joint checking account. So I kind of, that's where we just blow through money until the next payday.
Right.
So I kind of want to always know where that's at relative to payday so that I can just make an informed decision. So it's like, hey, we're going out for dinner. It's going to be this. Like, great. Check the account. We're good. Let's go.
What about your financial life is automated? And what have you decided not to automate? Bills, retirement savings, vacation savings,
yeah,
gift savings. What are you automating and what are you not automating?
Okay. Bills are automated, as many as possible. And savings are automated for emergencies. So things like we put a certain amount over to our emergency account and a certain amount into our travel account every month, and those are automated. What I don't automate is my annual savings to RRSPs or tax-free savings accounts. I usually will bulk do those once a year at the beginning of the year.
Do you have a separate account for travel savings?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I want to be able to be like, can we afford to go here? And then look at the account and be like, hell yeah, we can.
Yeah, we can. Or not happening.
Yeah.
What are you nuts about when it comes to money? And what are you super, like, whatever, no big deal?
Oh, that's a great question.
Okay. Like, I'm nuts about spending on groceries. I am ruthless. I can tell you the price of everything. I'm a super engaged grocery shopper. I am super lazy and not involved at all on things like insurance policies. I wish I could just get one and have it last forever and I would never have to research it. It takes everything in my being to reassess my insurance needs and get a competitive quote.
Okay, so I'm almost the opposite. So my most like lazy financial behavior, like disengaged, if you will, is like worrying about where my spending money goes. Like I do not budget. Like I don't know what I spend on groceries. I don't track it. I don't know exactly what's going on because as long as it's within that hard limit in my bank account, I don't personally care where my money goes after that, right?
But in the grocery store, do you buy the Gala apples for $1.99 or the imported Honeycrisp?
You don't pay attention. My husband does. And he can't believe I don't. He's shocked by it.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I don't pay attention to it. But where I'm anal and like on it is I monitor our cash flow, but from a macro point of view, not about where it's going, but like making sure that we always kind of have that money in the spending account, making sure we're putting money into our big purchases account or whatever. Like, I'm nuts about that. Like, I check in a lot with that, and I really care about that cash flow, but on a macro level, not on the micro level.
Do you have an actual financial plan?
Yes, I do, because I test my own software, and I made it one.
Ooh! And I ask that because a lot of people talk about it, but very few people actually have one.
Yeah, we do have one. I am also a Capricorn, so like making plans is kind of my thing.
Yeah.
So we have a short-term like cashless strategy plan, which is kind of the one I'm anal about. And then we have the longer-term, you know, big picture plan that I actually have in writing because when I was putting all this stuff together, I always like to test it on us. So I definitely have one.
Who manages your investments? DIY, robo, full service?
Robo.
You are a robo. So inside, you've got probably a mix of ETFs, maybe some mutual funds in there?
No mutual funds, ETFs only.
Who files your taxes? You are an accountant or a service?
Myself.
What was your, last and briefly, what has been your best financial move ever?
Oh, that's a great question. I held out on cheap rent and an old car for my entire 20s so that when we got big kid incomes, we just still lived like 20-year-olds and like 21-year-olds. And so we were able to save a bunch of money by not kind of like growing up with our incomes. And so by the time we hit our 30s, we had a nice little stash of cash.
So now do you have granite countertops?
God, no. I'm not that.
Never. I loved in your book you referenced a laundry room. People are like, what is that? How does that even work? Shannon, thank you so much for your time and your candor.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's great to be honest about money.
Shannon Lee Simmons, author of Living Debt Free, and that was How I Do It. That's our show for today. If you want some more moolala, you can download and subscribe to the podcast version of our show on anywhere you get podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, Spotify, all that. I'm around on social media. Facebook is Bruce Celery Moolala. Twitter @BruceCelery. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.